Okay, Jesse, I heard a rumor that we might be getting a classic ye olde love murder today. Could that be true?
Oh, yeah. An affair between a U.S. district attorney and a congressman's wife results in a murder in broad daylight only steps away from the White House. It's a ye olde, star-spangled scandal up in here, and the very first time the temporary insanity defense was used in court.
I'm Andy Cassette.
And I'm Jesse Prey, and this is Ye Olde Love Murder. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Jesse.
Welcome back, everyone, to Love Murder, a podcast about murky history, murder mysteries, and love gone fatally wrong.
You can find Love Murder on TikTok and Instagram at Love Murder Pod and on Facebook by searching Love Murder Podcast.
If you're enjoying the show, please help your girls out and love/murder a 5-star rating on your podcast app, subscribe, and leave a nice review.
Also, if you're interested in supporting the show more directly, head on over to patreon.com/lovemurderpod. Where you can learn all about the different tiers of support.
Very excited to shout out some great new patrons.
Crystal P. and Kelly O.
Karen S. and Hannah F.
And Lindy N.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you for being a patron. Thank you for tuning back in week after week and spending a little time with us. I'm feeling very NPR today because of our subject matter.
I was just listening to NPR, so that works.
Andy's a big NPR girl.
You like think it's funny.
It's not that I think it's funny. I think I'm like newsed out, man. So I listen to Alt Nation on Sirius XM, usually when I'm in the car. Andy and I have very opposite car situations. She likes it burning lava hot and listening to NPR. Well, I have the AC on almost year round and I like to listen to music.
You forgot one very important point.
What?
My car is usually very clean.
Yes, and my car never is. Correctamundo. So is your car more of a Jesse situation or an Andy situation? Tell us in the Instagram comments or the Patreon comments.
So funny.
And with that, I think we should get into the episode. In late February of 1859, 40-year-old Daniel Sickles was on top of the world. A former senator for New York, Daniel was in his second term at Congress and found that politics suited him very well. Smart, quick, and wily, he soon became known as Double Dealing Dan, or even Devil Dan. This is not to say that Daniel did not understand loyalty. He was loyal to President James Buchanan, who had helped him rise through the political ranks, and was actually the godfather of Dan's 6-year-old daughter, Laura. And though he had been quite the Lothario in his youth, and had also absolutely scandalized both New York and Washington, D.C. society, with his association with Fanny White, a famous courtesan and madam, he now felt very settled with his young, beautiful wife, Teresa. The relationship had also started with just a touch of scandal because Teresa had only been 15 years old when he wed her against her family's wishes.
You are lying.
Nope, they did it differently in the 1850s. But now he had it all. An enviable position in D.C., a stately home that offered views of the White House, good friends, good whiskey, and the love of a good woman. Or so he thought. On February 24th, 1859, he arrived home from the House of Representatives to a grand party thrown by his loving wife. The dinner and subsequent merriment was considered a success. Teresa looked more beautiful than ever, and partygoers later said that it was the most elegant and stylish dinner that had been thrown that entire Washington winter.
Oh.
After the brass band and merry revelers had all taken their leave for the night, Daniel went to his study to dive into his correspondence. Earlier that evening, a messenger had pressed a plain yellow envelope into his hand. He had tucked it into his pocket, unopened, and not given it a second thought. Until he sat in front of a crackling fire. The information contained within, however, would be the cause of a passionate anger, a primal rage, and a devastation of at least 3 lives, if not more. That would be Dan's, Teresa's, and one Mr. Philip Barton Key, the U.S. District Attorney. And if this letter was true, Andy, Teresa's illicit lover.
Okay, well, what did the letter say?
The mysterious sender wrote that it gave them no pleasure to inform the congressman that his wife and Mr. Key would meet for hours in a rented house. Quote, Key hangs a string out the window as a signal to her that he is there and leaves the door unfastened, and she walks in. And, sir, I do assure you, he has as much the use of your wife as you have.
I highly doubt that that author did not enjoy writing that letter.
Oh, the author enjoyed writing this letter very much. And we never find out who the mysterious author of this letter is.
Oh, my God, no.
Also, the person wrote at the end, with these few hints, I leave the rest for you to imagine.
Oh, yeah, he's leaving like little breadcrumbs.
He didn't leave much to the imagination when he says, as much the use of your wife as you have, sir.
How does he know that, though, if he's not in the room?
I don't know. I don't know. Maybe he's spying. He's got his binoculars. He's got his 1850s opera glasses. Yeah,
like, there's the string. What a way to be called, huh?
Well, imagine he did. And for many sleepless nights, Daniel would try to disprove this horrendous accusation. He would end up consulting people, trying to get investigators on this to figure out whether this could possibly be the case. And then he would confront his unfaithful wife and her paramour, and one of the three would not survive the encounter.
Whoa.
Well, this story is absolutely fascinating. I first came across it in a book called Jealous Rage, Stunning True Tales of Intimates, Passion, and Murder by R. Barry Flowers. And then I found my primary source for today's episode. It's called Star Spangled Scandal, Sex, Murder, Isn't that great? Star Spangled Scandal.
Man, these titles we've had recently have just been remarkable. Last week with the ballroom, it might well be called Murder on the Dance Floor.
It should have been called Murder on the Dance Floor. Why didn't we name that episode Murder on the Dance Floor?
Well, because they didn't actually get murdered on the dance floor, but all of the titles were so funny, like Gone Ballistic.
Yes, Gone Ballistic. And then so I forgot to give you guys the name of last week's book at the end because it was such a spoiler, but it was called And Then She Killed Him.
Yeah.
By Robert Scott. That was last week's. Yeah, Star Spangled Scandal. I wish that I could name the episode that, but I didn't want to totally bite off Chris DeRose's style. Sex, Murder, and the Trial That Changed America. It's an excellent book that sets the stage for this crime of passion that is coming in basically on the eve of the Civil War and discusses the ensuing trial's impact on the American justice system. It's also a steamy read. The coverage of this case in the newspapers was so hot, Andy, that some publishers were censured for publishing details of the affair.
Wow.
Yes. It is truly a ye olde love murder at the dawn of America and the birth of the temporary insanity defense. So let's talk about Devil Dan first, and then we'll get to Teresa and Philip Barton Key. Daniel was born on October 20th, 1819, into a fairly wealthy family. And he seemed to always be a handful, this guy. He was causing too much trouble in New York City, which is where he was born. So his parents shipped him off to boarding school in Glens Falls, New York, which is kind of where I grew up, between Galway and the Adirondacks, essentially.
So up there.
It's way up there. So they sent him very far away, especially back in the day. I think, I don't even know if there was a train that ran. So you were talking about a coach. You were being driven by horses. So it was going to take you a while to get back to New York City. But he was also a troublemaker there, and he was essentially kicked out of school, I think, and he was supposed to go back to New York City, and his parents were understandably upset with him about everything, and he was like, screw it then, I'm going to stay in Glens Falls, I'm going to go work for a newspaper, which he did. So he did that for a little while, and he spent the next couple years making his way back to New York City, working on different publications, and he did not use his family money. He was so charming that apparently he got people to welcome him into their homes, and he made a living working on different publications. He worked on a literary magazine that was helmed by none other than Edgar Allan Poe.
Wow.
I'm not sure if it was while he was there, but it was the same literary magazine that Edgar Allan Poe was editing that first published The Fall of the House of Usher.
Okay.
Finally, his parents said that they would support their son if he promised to come back to school. And he agreed. So they sent him to what is now known as NYU, New York University. And I think he was like in the dorms for a little bit. And then he went to board with a family that was friends, I think, of the family, but also was affiliated with the university. This was the DuPont family.
Oh, heard of them?
This is where he met his future wife, although she was only a child at the time, Teresa Baggioli. So Teresa's family patriarch, so her grandfather, was Lorenzo DuPont. And he was a poet laureate who had collaborated with Mozart.
Casual.
Super casual. It's so crazy how much name dropping goes on in this episode.
Oh, I can't wait.
Just rubbing shoulders left and right. So he had a ton of sex scandals, apparently, back in Vienna and Italy. And one that resulted in Teresa's mother, Maria, being born when he was in his 60s.
Okay.
And so they used to say that they had adopted Maria, Teresa's mom, but really it was his love child.
They love that excuse.
It's our adopted child. It's like, no, 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 no. So Teresa was the product of Maria and an Italian composer and symphony conductor named Antonio Baggioli. This house was full of music, art, philosophy, languages. Dan Sickles likely did not pay much heed to little Teresa, as he ended up leaving the house to study law and eventually opened his own law office in the city. He dabbled in Tammany Hall politics, rubbed shoulders with the elite, and ended up falling in love with Fanny White, the most high-end and successful madam in all of Manhattan.
Okay. Fanny.
So that was not her real name. I think her real name was like Jane Funk or something like that, but she went by Fanny White.
Okay.
Jane Augusta Funk was her real name. Fanny had been ruined, in quotes, by a seducer in her teens. So that's what they called a man who promised a young, naive woman marriage and then left her after he had stolen her virtue.
Very good description.
Yeah, back in the day, that was the end of the road for you. If you had had sex with some guy who had promised to give you everything and he peaced out, then you were considered ruined.
Yeah.
They said that it was the second cause of women being in sex work. The first was economics, just poverty. And the second was being ruined by a seducer.
So backwards.
It's so backwards. We do have to recall that we're talking about the 1800s here. I believe also her parents were agricultural. They might not have been alive later on in her life. And it was said that her brother basically threw her out and did not help protect her during this time. So Fanny, I think, started working in a restaurant, barely making ends meet, and eventually got into sex work. But she was really, really bright. She was funny. She was charismatic. She was said to be very good looking and eventually ended up working her way up in a bordello and then becoming a madam of the whole thing and really turning. I think there was two different places that she operated, but she turned them into very high end elite establishments where the fanciest people could go and have a place to, well, men rather. Could go and have drinks and be among what they thought of as their social class, but also be in the company of beautiful young women at the same time. So she was about 24 years old when Daniel started frequenting her establishment. He was around 27 at the time, and the two really hit it off. If it wasn't for the fact that Daniel was already pursuing a political career, I kind of think he would have married her.
Okay.
I think that he was somebody who liked to buck tradition.
Yeah.
And go against the grain. And if it wasn't that he was very specifically going into politics, I kind of got the impression that he would have said, screw it, and just married her. In fact, some of Fanny's bordello proceeds actually went to supporting Daniel's political campaigns.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and that was a rumor that haunted him for his entire political career about where he got some of his early campaign money. So around the time they met, he was elected to the New York Assembly. Despite this, he allegedly got into plenty of trouble. Apparently, women were not allowed in some saloons in the 1840s and 50s, so Fanny disguised herself as a man for a bar crawl, and they hit the town up. But she was very good-looking, according to the Times, rather, and it was soon discovered that obviously she was a woman, and they were both thrown in jail for the night because of this little charade.
Oh my goodness.
Dan also ruffled some serious feathers and was said to be censured by his political party for taking Fanny to the state assembly chamber in Albany and also swanning her around his hotel and introducing her to scandalized society members. So he was not hiding it.
I kind of love that.
Yes, he was a really interesting cat. He wrote to a friend around this time when he was getting in trouble for being a little wild. "I cannot play the courtier to the multitude, much less to individuals." Basically, he's saying, "I don't care. I don't care what you say. I'm not going to like play into what you want me to be." And then he said that he would not advise this course to a friend because he must always pay a price for doing things his way. But, quote, "I've adopted it. It is mine, and I will follow it come what may."
I guess that's the same when he marries a 15-year-old too, huh?
Yeah, let's not get too excited about this guy. Yeah.
Tracks.
Yeah, so I'm not sure if it was political pressure or just the chaos of his relationship with Fanny, because it did sound like it was pretty passionate and very up and down. But it seems like at some point Dan decided to move on with a familiar 15-year-old face in the fall of 1852. He apparently would go visit his former boarding family, the DuPonts and Bagiolis, every once in a while. And it had been a bit when he went back this time. And all of a sudden, little kid Teresa, who he had never really paid attention to, had bloomed into a beautiful teenager who spoke 5 languages fluently. And by all accounts seemed mature beyond her years, as all men say when they want to creep on a younger woman.
She's really 15 going on 30.
She's just so mature for her years.
So mature. I mean, she knows 5 languages. That's so mature.
So against both the Sickles and Bagioli family's wishes, the teenager who was 15 or 16 reportedly, and the assemblyman who was 32 years old at the time, wed on September 27th, 1852, in a secret civil ceremony that was performed by the mayor of New York.
Wow.
Yes. Well, Teresa's parents eventually gave in and accepted the marriage. They ended up throwing the couple a proper Catholic wedding 6 months later. One person who wasn't exactly thrilled for the newlyweds?
Miss Fanny.
Yeah, Fanny was not happy, and she allegedly chased Dan down at New York's Carlton Hotel and attacked him with a bullwhip.
What?
The drama!
A bullwhip?
A bullwhip. I think that's what Indiana Jones uses. Despite allegedly being head over heels for his young new bride, legend has it. Now, I saw this everywhere, like online, on his Wikipedia page. Chris DeRose, the author, who's probably more to be believed, said that this was not true. However, everybody else says it was. And it's just so much fun to believe that I'm going to roll with it, guys. He allegedly, while working as a United States diplomat to England, introduced Fanny to Queen Victoria. So the story goes that he introduced the famed madam, which of course would have been a scandal, to the queen as Miss Bennet of New York. According to Fanny's Wikipedia page, historians speculate that Dan did this, A, because it amused Fanny and she got a kick out of being presented to the queen like a proper lady. B, because he hated the monarchy. We have to remember, too, guys, that this is only about, what, 75 years out from the Revolutionary War?
Yeah.
So there was still some raw feelings between the two countries. And lastly, because he hated the editor of the New York Herald, who was named James Gordon Bennett. So it was a hilarious fuck you to both the monarchy and to a guy he didn't like. So this was both profound and petty, his FU.
But this totally tracks.
See, that's why I want to believe it, because it just seems very much in line with his personality.
And what he wrote himself.
Yes, exactly. Like, I'm doing it my way. So Christopher Rose said that he looked into the story and he found that only 8 women were presented to Queen Victoria during his time being the ambassador. And he did not present any of them. And I'm like, yeah, but wouldn't they like erase that from the records if it had happened? Wouldn't they say, you know, maybe we'll just scratch that one out because she was a very famous sex worker?
It's so crazy. I feel like also it's so insane to me that they wrote down every person that was presented to the queen.
Yes, of course they did.
So weird.
Well, by the time Teresa gave birth to their daughter, Laura, however, it seemed that Fanny and Dan had parted ways for good. She ended up with some other type of royalty for a little while. And then I think eventually settled down with an attorney that she got married to in her 30s. But then she died mysteriously only a month or two later, and they thought maybe her husband poisoned her.
What?
Yes, very fascinating. We should do a whole Patreon on Fanny, because she is also an absolutely fascinating person. In any account, it sounds like Dan and Fanny very permanently parted ways, and he may have been faithful to Teresa for at least a little while. Some accounts say that he had flings still. But then there's other accounts that say that he very purposely brought Teresa and Laura to D.C. when he was in session in Congress, which was not something that a lot of other politicians did. They usually left their families in their home states when they went to D.C. for Congress. So it seemed like he was doing his best to keep his family together and maybe himself on the straight and narrow. After moving to D.C., Teresa became a well-known and celebrated socialite. So they seemed like they're living the dream at this point. Daniel was beloved by then-President James Buchanan, who considered him, quote, a man of fine talents, of excellent manners, and of a brave and loyal temper. They moved in the most illustrious political circles, and by the time they moved down there, they met the acquaintance of one Mr. Philip Barton Key. Now, the Key family was basically American royalty. Key's father, Francis Scott Key, wrote the Star-Spangled Banner.
Lol.
Yes, that's why I think it's called Star-Spangled Scandal. Key was one of 8 siblings who had all married very well. I mean, this was still in the time of political marriages. So his aunt was married to a Supreme Court justice. His sisters were married to congressmen. He ended up marrying a woman named Ella Swan, whose father was the head of the Bank of Baltimore.
Also, her name's Ella Swan.
Which is just a great name.
Unbelievable.
They had 4 children while Philip Barton Key became an attorney, and he also pursued politics himself. Old Key was definitely on the wrong side of history, however. One of his more famous cases was prosecuting Daniel Drayton, a very brave ship captain who sought to free 77 slaves by sailing them to the north.
Wow.
And thus freeing them. But sadly, one of the slave owners whose slave he was freeing had a boat and managed to catch him and shot at them and detained them until the police could arrive.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm. Also, it was really revolting to read some of Key's arguments about why Daniel Drayton, who is a hero, should be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law.
Gross.
Because he was saying that basically it's worse than just theft, because the slaves essentially were like capable of being brainwashed by him. So it's not just like stealing something else. It's somehow worse. And it's like, this whole argument is horrible. Oh my God. Are you not hearing yourself? This is unbelievable.
Ugh.
Yeah. So we don't love this guy, we gotta say. And the fucked up thing too is that we don't really know his feelings on real slavery, because at the time, a lot of people were into slavery because of politics. They were like, oh, it's so great for the economy, and they were following political lines. It's nuts. And he's also originally from the DC area. Obviously, a lot of the South wanted to keep slavery because it was free labor.
And racist.
Horrifically so. It was denying personhood. It was denying humanity in every essence of the word. So he's not a great guy. We're not pro-key here.
No.
No, we are anti-key. His wife, Ella, did pass away at a rather young age, it sounds like. I think it was some sort of disease. And after that, Philip became a womanizing widower, allegedly known as the most handsome man in Washington. He's got kind of like a Clive Owen thing going on. I saw a portrait.
Okay.
That's probably the most generous I can be towards him.
Knowing who he is.
Yes. Born and raised in Georgetown, Philip was the true definition of a DC insider. And he graciously helped the Sickles family settle in, even negotiating the lease of their fine house. So you can imagine Daniel's shock these 3 years later when a mysterious letter arrived accusing his wife of having an affair with the man he considered to be a true loyal friend.
What's the saying? There's no real friends in DC.
This case would prove that true. Andy, you know that I am obsessed with longevity. Well, I've been sleeping on this Blissy pillowcase, and let me tell you, I did not know that a pillowcase could have anti-aging qualities.
Oh, yeah. Set yourself up with better sleep with Blissy's award-winning 100% mulberry silk pillowcases. It reduces frizz, tangles, and prevents breakage. That's because it keeps the moisture in your hair and keeps your skincare products and natural moisture on your skin, while cotton literally absorbs it off of your face. Say goodbye to wrinkles, dry, flaky, and red skin in the morning, and wake up with healthier and shinier hair.
There are a lot of dupes out there that claim satin can be an alternative to silk, but that's just not the case. The pillowcase. Satin is made from synthetic fibers like polyester, while silk is a luxurious, all-natural fiber. Silk is more breathable, moisture-wicking, and gentle. It's also more durable and longer-lasting. Think of it as an investment in getting better sleep and waking up feeling ready to take on the day.
Blissy pillowcases are made of 100% mulberry silk, which is naturally hypoallergenic, so you can sleep more comfortably without itching or rashes. And unlike other silk pillowcases, these are of the highest quality silk, and this is the real winning point for me, they're machine washable and durable.
Necessary when you are a working mother.
Absolutely.
If any of you guys are side sleepers like me, you will know about the dreaded wake-up wrinkle where your,
oh my God.
Your
I know.
Cheek comes up and hits your face. I was shocked that when I slept with a Blissy silk pillowcase, I did not have my side sleeping wake-up wrinkle in the morning.
We need the Blissy pillowcases, but like sheet sets and comforters too, because I'm starting to get the chest wrinkles too, or
yes.
Like the arm wrinkles in the morning, and I'm like, oh.
Okay, Blissy, we need like a full set. Roll it out.
Everybody loves them, honestly. I gave them all to my family during the holidays as well, and they were the best. They have a ton of different prints and colors. They make great gifts, and there's literally an option for anyone. Men love them too. They have over 1 million raving fans, and you could be next.
Try now, risk-free, for 60 nights at blissy.com/lovemurder and get an additional 30% off. That's blissy.com/lovemurder and use code lovemurder to get an additional 30% off. Your skin and hair will thank you. So the morning after Danielle received this letter, he was a hot mess. I read in another article that not only had he not been faithful himself, but that he had previously accused Teresa of cheating. Though evidence would suggest that it might have just been more guilty projection on his part, like she hadn't had an affair up until this one. Danielle turned to a trusted friend to discuss the matter. He obviously has to keep this private because he can't let people know what his wife's been up to. And the two of them spent the day investigating the claims. It did not take long, sadly, for the rumors to be substantiated.
Ooh.
He finds some witnesses, and we're going to talk about the witnesses who say that this is actually happening, that this affair is happening. But at first they say that it happened on, I think, a Tuesday or something that people saw her with him. And he's like, ha ha, the maid says that she was home all day Tuesday, so this is a lie. And then the people were like, oh, no, I'm sorry, I got it confused. It was Wednesday. And he's like, the maid says she was gone all day Wednesday. God damn it. He was trying. He was really reaching. He was definitely like in denial for a little bit.
Yeah.
He did, in fact, lease a house a few blocks from the Sickles residence. And witnesses had seen the couple entering and exiting at staggered times. The Sickles' coachman admitted to driving Teresa and even Key at various times when Daniel was out of town.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. And most horrifying to Daniel was that there was significant scuttlebutt floating around the Washington society scene, meaning that people were already talking. People knew about this. This was hot gossip for 1859. The tea was piping.
The scuttlebutt tea.
The scuttlebutt tea. He is horrified that people seem to know about it. It seemed like Teresa might have been initially narked on by somebody who wanted to be her lover, but had been turned down. There was this guy named Stephen Beekman, who was described as violently in love with Teresa, and apparently did not keep his feelings much of a secret. And he must have been borderline stalking her because he was the one who noticed just how much time Philip Barton Key was spending with the object of his own affection. So he was telling people like, oh, well, when Daniel's out of town, I witnessed her with him on three different occasions. I guess he was just following her around, hoping to sniff around her and get in his own opportunity. And he was probably just pissed that Key beat him to the punch. And though Key officially denied all of the rumors, there were other accounts that claimed that behind closed doors, he was very braggy about the affair.
Ew.
Yes. Stephen Beekman said that another reason he was upset about this, other than his own feelings about Teresa, was that Key allegedly bragged to him that given 36 hours with any woman, he could make her do whatever he wanted.
A little full of himself, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. One friend of Key's said that he went as far to say in this gentleman's club they were hanging out in, quote, Sickles' wife is my whore.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm. When friends and advisors told him he was playing a dangerous game, politically, as well as just generally, because you could get killed for such a thing, Key said that he loved a good French intrigue and that it was the spice of danger that made this romance exciting. He also suggested that he was prepared for any emergency and tapped his breast pocket where he allegedly kept a pistol and said, quote, Sickles is a damned Yankee and would do nothing if he found out.
Wow.
And many people said that Philip Barton Key liked to participate in risky business. He almost seemed to have some sort of a death wish. He had attempted to duel or otherwise kill two men already, a man who had killed his brother in a duel, as well as a former suitor of his then fiancée. There was another story about how he ran into a burning building to save the portrait of a senator's deceased wife. I guess the house was burning down. And the senator was outside and he was really upset because it was the only portrait of his dead wife. And so Philip ran into the burning building and came out with the portrait and everyone cheered for him. And then he turned it around and it wasn't of his wife. It was a portrait of the senator as a young man. Oh, nice try. Nice try, Key.
It's just hard to imagine this man doing any of this when I'm also trying to imagine him literally dangling a string looking like he's about to play with a kitty cat.
He's like, Teresa, hello, the string. So this guy is engaging in a lot of thrill-seeking behavior, probably has some sort of personality disorder if he was living in today's times, is considered the handsomest man in Washington, and doesn't seem to give one flying fuckaroo whether or not he's ruining Teresa's life.
He doesn't care at all.
No.
No fuckaroos are given.
Zero fuckaroos are given here. After Daniel collected all of this gut-churning evidence and innuendo, he went to Teresa to confront her with what he knew. Teresa admitted to the affair and cried as Daniel forced her to write down her confession. So we know exactly what Teresa admitted to, which was quite a lot.
Wow.
And this is 1859. So, guys, what I'm about to read to you was considered very scandalous.
A lot of ink dipping, huh?
A lot of ink dipping. I have been in a house in 15th Street with Mr. Key. How many times? I do not know. I believe the house was unoccupied. Commenced going there the latter part of January. Have been in alone and with Mr. Key. Usually stayed an hour or more. There was a bed in the second story. I did what is usual for a wicked woman to do. The intimacy commenced this winter when I came from New York in that house. An intimacy of an improper kind. Have met half a dozen times or more at different hours of the day. On Monday of this week and Wednesday also. We arranged meetings when we met in the street and at parties. Never would speak to him when Mr. Sickles was at home, because I knew he did not like me to speak to him. Did not see Mr. Key for some days after I got there. He told me he had hired the house as a place where he and I could meet. I agreed to it. I had nothing to eat or drink there. The room is warmed by a wood fire. Mr. Key generally goes first. I bet he does.
That's what she said.
Yeah. Have walked there together, say, 4 times. I do not think more. I was there on Wednesday last, between 2 and 3. This next part is what really pissed Daniel off. Laura, that's their daughter, was at Mrs. Hoover's. Mr. Key took her and left her there at my request. So her affair partner took their child to the nanny's house, basically.
And how old is the child now? How old is Laura?
She's 6. From there, I went to 15th Street to meet Mr. Key. From there to the milkwoman's. Immediately after Mr. Key left Laura at Mrs. Hoover's, I met him. And then she's talking about how she would get into the house, who might have seen her. Mr. Key has kissed me in this house a number of times. I do not deny that he has had connection in this house. Connection? Is that what they're calling intercourse? Last spring, a year ago. So she's saying that he has kissed her in their house, that they have also hooked up in the parlor on the sofa of his house. This is 1859 deets right now.
Maybe just like zip it.
Yeah, why is she saying all this?
She like wanting to be an erotic novelist.
Mr. Sickles was sometimes out of town and sometimes in the capital. I think the intimacy commenced in April or May of 1858. I do not think it is safe to meet him in this house because there are servants who might suspect something. You think? Mr. Key has ridden in Mr. Sickles' carriage. That's not all of Mr. Sickles' things he has ridden. And has called at his house without Mr. Sickles' knowledge. And after my being told not to invite him to do so and against Mr. Sickles' repeated request. She signed the letter with her maiden name, so she knows things are not looking good. Teresa Baggioli. A legalistic postscript also followed. This is a true statement written by myself without any inducement held out by Mr. Sickles of forgiveness or reward, and without any menace from him. This I have written with my bedroom door open and my maid and child in the adjoining room at 8:30 in the evening. And then she gives her address and signs it February 26, 1859.
How old is she at this time?
She's 23 years old.
Yeah, I mean, it's the time to knock your socks off, you know?
Yeah, that's what happens when you get married at 15.
Yeah.
After the letter was written and handed over to Daniel, he demanded her wedding ring. Now, the maid is witnessing all of this. So the maid is telling people what happened.
Okay.
And she gave it to him. So he's like, and give me your wedding ring. And she takes it off. And apparently they slept in different rooms. But Teresa would not sleep on the bed because she was sobbing that she didn't deserve a bed. So the maid is in the middle of all this. And she said literally all night, both husband and wife were crying.
The maid is the original Gossip Girl.
She is. She's like this Irish maid. I just wish I could do the accent. Who's like, I don't know what the fuck is going on here. Everybody's crying. Teresa's like, I don't deserve a bed for my wickedness. And like screaming and crying. Oh my gosh. So the very next morning, there was still so much drama. Teresa was still like laying on the ground, refusing to move. Meanwhile, a friend of Daniel's came to visit him to check on him. And Daniel, like, handed him the letter and then, like, put his face in the bed pillows and said, I am a dishonored and ruined man and I cannot look you in the face. Well, so he's, like, putting his face in his bed.
I mean, yeah, that's, like, pretty embarrassing.
What you're doing right now, bro. Yeah,
it's
It's not because your wife cheated on you. It's because of this moment right here.
What you're doing right here, this situation.
Yeah, I guess the friend was like, bro, this is not a situation that you cannot recover from. You can recover from this. You're not ruined. He's like, look, Congress was almost out of session. So he's like, just say that the session's ending soon. So you're just sending Teresa back to New York to get your home life settled back there. And then go to Europe for a little while, divorce her, leave her over there for a little bit. By the time you come back, everyone will have forgotten about the whole drama.
I love that advice.
I think it's great advice. Send her on a European vacation and just let her be. And then everyone will just forget. He did not think that that was a solution. He was just real, real devastated, real dark. He's like, let's go to the club and get drunk. Let's just go get drunk, which also, sure, that's also a solution at this point. So him and his friend go out to the men's club to go have a drink and ponder his choices. Like, what can he do now? They leave and Philip Barton Key comes pouncing around. He's got a handkerchief and he's like waving the handkerchief.
What is up with him just waving things?
He's waving the handkerchief outside, staring at Teresa's window, trying to get her attention, but he doesn't know she's on the floor crying because he has no idea what's going on. Meanwhile, while he's pouncing around with the handkerchief, one of the servants came out walking the dog, and apparently, like, the dog ran over to him, and he's like, hey, can you get Teresa? And the servant's like, I don't think that's a good idea, guy. I'm going to go back inside now. Then this young woman who knew Philip Barton Key crossed his path, and she asked him how he was doing, and he said, I've been despondent about my health lately. Indeed, he was quoted as saying, I have half a mind to go out on the prairies and try buffalo hunting. The excursion would either kill me or cure me, and I don't really care which.
Oh my God, he's so dramatic.
Everyone in this case is so dramatic. People think that we're extra now. They were not around for this. Real Housewives of DC over here.
Real Housemen.
Real Housemen. Daniel Sickles comes back from the club and he is incensed that Philip Barton Key is pouncing around his house, waving his old handkerchief around.
He's in his house?
Well, he's like outside. He's walking around outside trying to get Teresa's attention.
Oh my God, what an idiot.
At that point, Danielle advances upon him and says, Key, you scoundrel. And Key's like, what's up, dog? Apparently he was like, what? What are you saying? Like, he was like, oh, hello there, friend. What's going on? He goes, you have dishonored my house. You must die. And Key managed to squeak out, what for? Before Danielle pulled out a pistol and he just started shooting. It's like that Danny DeVito meme where he's like, and I just started blasting.
I don't know that meme, but I need to see it now.
It's like a clip from Always Sunny in Philadelphia where he's like, and I just started blasting or something like that. And he's like holding up some guns, something like that. But yeah, he just starts firing at him over and over again. And the first shot he missed or it misfired or something. So he falls to the ground, Key, and he knows now that he's in it. This guy's going to kill him. So he reaches into his pocket where he's always suggested he kept a pistol himself.
Wait, wait, wait. And he grabs a string.
No, he grabs some opera glasses, like binoculars that he probably had in his pocket to spy on Teresa or try to like look in her window. And so he obviously thought his gun was in there. His gun is not in there. So he takes the opera glasses out and he throws them at the man with the gun. Well, apparently first he stood up and like was trying to hit him. Daniel's got the gun and he's like hitting him. Daniel starts firing on him and he's like, ah, so he runs away and he like runs behind a tree and like throws the opera glasses at him. And he's like, at first he tried to say like, don't shoot me, don't shoot me. And then
he's waving the handkerchief saying, I surrender.
He's trying to surrender essentially. And then Daniel's like full Inigo Montoya from Princess Bride mode. You know, it's like he in that movie where he's like, you killed my father, prepare to die. And he just screams that over and over again while he's killing that guy. This was him. He keeps saying, you have dishonored my house. You must die. And he just keeps repeating that while he's like trying to fire at him. And so Philip Barton Key like gives up and he just starts screaming at everybody who's in the square. Because this is literally in Lafayette Square, right across the White House. And he's going, murder, murder, don't murder me. Murder is happening here.
Key, I thought you were totally fine with getting murdered by a buffalo.
Yes, yeah, so there's like a ton of people watching this happen. And he was right. He totally got murdered.
Oh, no. Wait, I thought this was going to have another twist.
No, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on whose side you're on, Philip Barton Key, district attorney for the United States and son of the man who wrote the Star-Spangled Banner, died across the street from the White House.
Let's not forget he was also pro-slavery.
It's hard to feel too bad for this guy.
Truly, truly.
Yeah, and so while he's murdering him, while he's like, he's advancing on him and just keeps shooting and shooting and shooting, the crowd finally like ran and pulled him off and was trying to save Key, but he was like, Dunsville. And the only thing Daniel said was, is the damned scoundrel dead? No regrets.
Zero.
Zero regrets. So I think you can see why Daniel Sickles' defense team was going to need a very creative legal strategy here.
Yeah, I don't know if that's that creative. I think that's pretty valid and true that he may have had temporary insanity.
I think he was temporarily insane. So when Daniel eventually went to trial, his attorneys would argue that it was clear that this sane, smart, respectable politician had experienced temporary insanity after finding out that his wife was unfaithful with this horrible man and that he had committed a totally understandable crime of passion. After all, his attorneys would eventually say, wouldn't you do the same thing if this man lay with your wife? And also, didn't that dick, Philip Barton Key, kind of deserve it?
Did they actually, in trial?
It was in fancier language, obviously, but they're like, how bad do we really feel about this?
I mean, he was yelling murder in the square and no one was running to his rescue.
I'm being murdered!
Everyone's like, all right.
It would seem as though most of America believed that he did deserve it. The telegraph had recently been invented, and I guess that this was how information was spreading at the time. The wires were just lit up with every dirty detail and every nugget of information about the affair between a congressman's beautiful young wife and the district attorney of the United States, who also just happened to be, like I said, the son of the guy who wrote the Star-Spangled Banner. So this was like the hottest gossip, best news, craziest true crime anybody had ever heard in this era. This is like Kardashians meets OJ, which I guess is just the Kardashians because they were also part of OJ.
He was like the OG Nepo baby.
He was. Oh my God, they were already down with the Nepo babies back then.
Wowzer.
Yeah, this is exactly where Olivia Pope from Scandal would have definitely come in. Daniel needs a fixer now because he murdered his rival in front of lots and lots of people.
Yeah, how would they even fix that in the square?
Just pay off everyone who was in the square. You didn't see nothing.
It was a theatrical performance.
Yes. Daniel Sickles' trial began on April 4th, 1859. The prosecution's case was clear. It's like, this man shot another man in front of tons of witnesses. He gave his victim absolutely no chance to defend himself. He could have at least said, let's have a duel or something.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that would have been, like, so much better.
That's what the prosecution was like. They're like, with no chance for him to get his own weapon and kill each other mutually. So they're saying that it's a cowardly move to just go up and start shooting somebody out of the blue, and this is going to ruin society as we know it if we allow anyone with a grievance to just start killing.
I mean, it's kind of cowardly to bone someone else's wife, too.
And they said, don't let this guy get away with murder just because you feel bad for him and because he's a congressman. He's been getting away with stuff his whole life. Let's just not give him a pass on murder, okay? That's the prosecution's case. Daniel's attorney sought to prove the affair and essentially make it make sense of what Daniel's mental state was at the time of the murder, hence the first use of the temporary insanity defense in a U.S. court. Now, interestingly, Daniel tried to block his own attorneys from using the confession letter. He did not want it entered into evidence because
he should definitely enter it.
Yes, you should, because that would make anyone crazy, that letter. But he argued that his wife's reputation had already been ruined And he wanted to try to spare Teresa any additional humiliation.
Well, that's very sweet, but then he knows he's going to go to jail.
Yes, and that's what his attorneys were fighting with him about, because they're like, you could go to jail, or worse, you could be killed. You could be hanged for this if you don't allow us to use this letter. And he refused. He said he'd rather go to prison for life or die than further humiliate his wife, who had...
That's really honorable.
It's very honorable. And luckily for him, the court system agreed, because his attorneys were like, we don't give a shit. We're going to do it behind your back. We are going to save your life. And so they did it without his approval. But then the judge was like, oh, no, this is too scandalous. This cannot be read in court, and wouldn't allow it into evidence.
Wow.
Yeah. So it didn't get read. However, it was leaked by court officials against Daniel's will, obviously. And that's how we know what it says today, by historians.
Thank God.
Yes, I'm so glad we know. So the letter was not allowed in. Beyond temporary insanity and laying the foundation for countless future crimes of passion, Daniel's attorneys also railed against a system that did not criminalize adultery. Now, there were a handful of states that did criminalize adultery. I think Massachusetts was one of them, because Puritans.
Oh, yeah. Them and their brothels.
Yes. But it was not in the District of Columbia. It was not a crime. So they were saying that legally you are allowed to kill a man for entering your house for trespassing against your will. So why shouldn't you be allowed to kill a man for entering your wife without your permission?
Potatoes, potatoes.
Yeah.
Tomatoes, tomatoes.
Now, the argument is misogynistic, of course, because it does equal your wife to your property. But you can see how it was very compelling to an all-male jury of 1859. His attorneys argued, quote, our legal system does not reach every case. There are certain wrongs which are not punished, and therefore the only law in such events is that traced in the human bosom by the finger of God, the law of human nature and instinct. When the law does not protect us, we are thrown on our own instincts and have the right to defend ourselves from wrong. In this district, you have provided no protection against adultery. The inevitable result is that you are thrown upon the principle of self-defense to protect yourselves and your own. The law tells you you may take the life of a burglar, but it still permits your house to be polluted by the tread of an adulterer. If a man comes into your house against your will and lies in your bed, that is a trespass, and you can put him out by force. And yet, if he lies down by your wife and takes from her that which cannot be restored, according to the hypothetic position of the prosecution, he is not entitled to any redress at all. By your verdict in this case, gentlemen of the jury, you will strike terror into the heart of the adulterer, or you will embolden him in his course. It's up to you.
Wow.
One of the aggravated features of this case was that Mr. Key entered the abode of Mr. Sickles as a friend. The hearts of these two men have beaten almost against each other. When Mr. Sickles invited Mr. Key into his house and Mr. Key entered for the purpose of accomplishing the downfall of his wife, he was as much a trespasser as if he entered it without an invitation. I submit that Philip Barton Key seduced the wife of Daniel E. Sickles, and in a transport of frenzy, Sickles sent him into his long account.
Wow.
And then this is where they set up the temporary insanity defense. The question which I present to your mind is this. When a man receives provocation, which excites him in an amount of frenzy which he cannot control, is he responsible for what he does under the influence of that frenzy? It is folly to punish a man for what he cannot help doing. If you concede that the transport is such that he cannot control it, you cannot make him criminally responsible for what he does under the influence of that transport. So if you believe that he was really out of his mind with this horrible feeling, then you can't hold him legally responsible for what he did. He also argued that basically Daniel Sickles did everybody there a favor, because who was next? Your wife? Your daughter? Your sister? Who would Key have run through next? On Tuesday, April 26th, 1859, after a three-week-long trial, the jury took less than 2 hours, including praying for a little bit right at the beginning, to deliberate. So what do you think they decided, Andy?
Well, considering the jury is all men who are probably all married, I would say that they said manslaughter guilty.
Not guilty.
Wow.
Totally free and clear, baby.
Wow. Oh, my God.
Yeah, they're like, not guilty, totally understandable. We don't want him to have to suffer a day longer. Let that man out of prison. He's a hero. It definitely seemed like most of public opinion was on Daniel's side. Obviously, there was a portion of DC that was friendly with the Keys because they were prominent.
Of course. I was going to say the Keys' friends and family.
Yeah, they weren't psyched, but apparently 2,000 people celebrated his acquittal that night in Washington. They all came out for a rousing speech by his attorney and partied at a tavern.
Partied in the square.
Yeah. Author Chris DeRose wrote that this ushered in a period of time in American history where there was a, quote, unwritten law, meaning that if some seducer ruined your wife, your sister, your daughter, well, you're basically justified in killing him.
For how long?
It lasted for a while. We're going to get into this. It's kind of hilarious. He said that the term came from the New York Herald that wrote, after this acquittal, "Let the race of Lotharios beware. It may be considered as the unwritten law of this country that a man may kill with impunity the seducer of his sister or the paramour of his wife."
Wow.
Yeah. And Frederick Douglass pointed out that this law only applied to white men, clearly, because countless enslaved men were forced to live through their wives being fully taken against their wishes. And had one of those men killed the slave owner who was doing such atrocities, just how do you think that would have gone? This was actually a very good cultural moment. This was like trending news, essentially, this trial. And Frederick Douglass got in on the discussion to bring it back to what was really important and what was really going on at the time, which was the abolitionist movement and the brewing Civil War. And it was actually a very smart point to make. I mean, it's Frederick Douglass, so of course it is. But it did actually get through to a lot of people who were really pro this unwritten law to see Black people as humans and see what they had been going through. Like, if you're pro Daniel Sickles killing this man, how could you not be pro what Black men and women have been suffering? And essentially bringing it back to that moment. And eventually, you know, it only took another 40 years, I think, 30 years. Even in the South, the courts agreed. And in 1893, the governor of South Carolina pardoned a Black man for the killing of a white man who was having sex with his wife.
Wow. Okay.
And that governor declared publicly that the unwritten law was as good for the Black man as it was for the white man.
South Carolina.
I know. 1893, too. Author Chris DeRose wrote that it wasn't a huge study of cases. I think it was like 201 cases in this study. But in that small selection of cases, the unwritten rule defense worked in 85% of the court cases. It even worked in court cases where the woman got on the stand and said, "No, I didn't have an affair with him. This defense is a lie. I was not having an affair with that man." And it still worked. They just believed that the woman was lying about it.
Oh, my goodness.
Yep. He wrote that the last successful uses of the unwritten law defense were used as recently as 1954 and 1958. And get this, both killers in the 1954 and the 1958 case were dentists.
Wait, that is so funny.
So society at large not only forgave, but celebrated Daniel Sickles. Until he did something much more unforgivable.
Oh, no.
Which was taking his wife back. He ended up losing his political career over publicly forgiving Teresa.
Okay. I'm, like, very proud of him for doing that.
Yeah. So he said, "I love her. We are staying together. We are putting this past us. We are raising our daughter. And I don't care what you all say about it," but people were pissed. They thought it was very unfair that Philip Barton Key lost his life over the affair and Teresa didn't lose anything. I was like, I don't know. I don't think her life's been easy since this happened. She was ruined and chased out of society. And they just wanted to punish her more.
Well, it's because everyone hates women.
They do. And they're punishing him for not punishing his wife.
Yep.
So yeah, he was really ahead of his time though, because he didn't give a shit if it ruined his career. He said he was going to stand by his wife no matter what. And there's different accounts. Now, in Star Spangled Scandal, he writes that he really did love Teresa and they really truly reconciled. There's differing accounts that say that the last few years of their marriage was not very romantic and that he did this just as a front. But that doesn't make any sense because he lost his political career over staying with her. So if it was a front, it wasn't a very well thought out one. I also wonder if he had any guilt about his own affairs. And I also think maybe this whole situation reminded him of his first love, the courtesan Fanny White, whose whole life was ruined by some guy who seduced her. So maybe he was putting it in context of, like, this was a man who was known to do this. He had also seduced other women. And Teresa was young and naive and things happen. In any case, he forgave her, but the marriage only lasted about 7 or 8 more years because she died of tuberculosis at the very young age of 31 years old.
The old TB, it used to get you.
Sadly, their daughter Laura also died relatively young. She died at 38 years old in 1890, and I think it was another type of illness.
Wasn't 38 like 75 back then?
It was probably pretty old back then.
Inflation.
Well, shockingly, Devil Dan, or Double Dealing Dan Sickles, outlived them all. He became a decorated general for the Union Army, that's the North in the Civil War, as well as a close personal friend of President Abraham Lincoln.
Awesome. I, for a moment, thought you were going to say decorator. And I was like, wow, he really took a career path.
He really pivoted there. Though he won the Medal of Honor for actions during the Battle of Gettysburg, he was still extremely controversial, even in the battle for which he later was awarded the Medal of Honor, because he apparently didn't like his major general. So he's a general, so the only people above him were the major generals. Apparently, he decided to not listen to his major general and ended up taking his regiment not where he was supposed to go, and a bunch of them died, and he lost a leg to a cannonball. Dan's leg was destroyed by a freaking cannonball. But it turns out that by doing so, the Confederate Army basically attacked all of them and were distracted by his stupid move, that the rest of the regiments could, like, outflank them and win. So he disobeyed orders, got a whole bunch of people killed, and lost his leg, but might have won the battle. So, Medal of Honor.
Wow.
And I think this is hilarious. After his leg was amputated, he donated the leg, so I guess probably just the skeleton, to the Army Medical Museum. So Dan Sickles' bones of his leg are in a museum somewhere.
Wow.
Yeah. From 1869 to 1874, he served as U.S. Minister to Spain, where he was rumored to have had an affair with the Queen of Spain.
Okay.
He's like, I only have one leg, but I'm still a tripod. Wink.
Yeah.
And then he did get married for the second time to a Spanish woman named Carmina. And they had 2 children named Edna and Stanton, but it seems like he was not a good family man. Family number 2 did not fare much better than Daniel's first family. It seemed like he didn't bring them to the States when he was done being U.S. minister. Like, he blocked them from coming to the States, and as a result, he was estranged from his family for many years. Eventually, his wife came over, and their children were pretty much grown by then. And he left nothing to his second wife in his will, and his adult daughter sued him at some point.
Oh, my goodness.
So don't think that Devil Dan had some good family relationships at that point in his life. On Sunday, May 3rd, 1914, Daniel Sickles died in his Fifth Avenue, New York City townhouse at the ripe old age of 94 years old.
Holy shit. I didn't even know people lived that long back then. That's like 130 in today's years.
It is. He was lauded as a politician and a war hero, but he will always best be remembered as a murderer. And that is the truly incredible case of Daniel Sickles, Philip Bartenke, and Daniel's wife, Teresa.
Just wow.
Guys, times change, but people don't. In conclusion, watch out for those seducers and ruiners of women.
Yeah, and if you're in a square somewhere and someone's yelling, murder, probably a good idea to, like, run but get some help from someone. Don't just pull out the popcorn.
Maybe try to stop the murder.
Maybe.
I'm being murdered over here. And as always, trust your gut when it comes to love so no one gets murdered while throwing their opera glasses at a man. Bye.
Toodles.